This is a copy of the fascicle that we're studying. This Genzo A Sesshin. This Eye Treasury Assembly Mind Collection. Eye Treasury Assembly. Speaking about how Genzo is short for Shobo Genzo, True Dharma Eye Treasury, and A means like an assembly or gathering. So Genzo A is an Eye Treasury gathering. And again, Genzo A Sesshin is an Eye Treasury gathering, mind collection, mind collector. Heart touching. You could also translate Sesshin. It's an assembly for heart touching and collecting the mind. In the collecting it all together in the treasury of the eye ball, the true Dharma eye. And it's a group exploration. It's together exploring a Dharma Eye Treasury fascicle of Dogen. And I was listening to a talk of Shohaku Okamura Roshi, who was my inspiration for offering these Genzo A Sesshins. He may be the only one doing this, I'm not sure, in this country now. And he prefaced some talk by saying, my presentation of, I've been studying Dogen for 50 years, he said, but this is not like some definitive presentation of what is meant by Dogen's words. It's like, I don't understand. I'm looking into this. My understanding is constantly changing. Every time I teach one of these fascicles, I hear something new in it. So there's no final understanding. I think particularly for Dogen's writings and the Shobo Genzo, they have this way that they're highly interpretable. And I think that's one of the most beautiful things about them, is that it's not like, oh, here it is. Dogen just says it very clearly, like it is. We all understand and go home. It's more that it's a lifetime project to study Dogen. With the spirit of inquiry, but without grasping a particular meaning that we're claiming is what Dogen means, and together we can explore and then see how these teachings affect our practice, especially in Sesshin where we're sitting a lot. They maybe can seep into our mind stream in ways that we are conscious of and unconscious of. And this can start with the vow that we just recited of Dogen, particularly appropriate for a Dogen Sesshin. We vow with all beings from this life on throughout countless lives, endlessly. If there are future lives and we're reborn in them, whether or not we hear of anything that's called Buddhism at that time. We still vow to hear the true Dharma in life after life. And that upon hearing it, no doubt will arise in us, nor will we lack in faith and trust. So, doubt may arise in us, but our vow is to let go of the doubt and open to the natural faith or trust that is part of our actual nature. I would propose the more we, more settled we are in the present, the more open we are to Dharma, and the more the heart can be touched by Dharma. So if we have doubts, we shouldn't try to abolish them. That's not the way to relieve doubts, but to actually just open more and more deeply to our present experience, which in the case of these talks is affected probably by lots of words. Our present experience is influenced by lots of words and ideas. And though Dogen says, just wholeheartedly sit, put aside all intellectual understanding and just sit in the present, he offers us lots of words. So we've been talking, for those arriving today, we've been talking about the hero of this fascicle called One Bright Pearl is a teacher named Xuan Sha. And Dogen just praises him a little bit with a kind of the biographical stories about how he was a austere and devoted practitioner and very keen on observing his own experience, so that when he was leaving his teacher and he stubbed his toe on a rock, hardly, firmly stubbed, so that it started bleeding and he's in great pain, and he said to himself, I've heard and been studying all this time that this body really doesn't exist, and yet where does this pain come from? So a doubt arose in him that maybe his pain hadn't been strong enough to really arouse that doubt until that time. So he turned around from his beginning of his pilgrimage and went back to his teacher Shui Feng and continued to practice there. And then Dogen says that he that Xuan Sha only practiced with Shui Feng. Apart from his practice with Shui Feng, he had no other teacher. And so we talked just a bit about that yesterday, and how any teacher can help open people to Dharma, and any student can open to Dharma, and yet he practiced with this one teacher. And then one of Xuan Sha's main disciples was named Ditzong. That was kind of his nickname. Ditzong is Chinese for Jizo, in Japanese, or Earth Store. His actual Dharma name was Luohan Guichen. Luohan means arhat, so maybe he didn't want to have a kind of Shravaka name like arhat, so he took on a Bodhisattva name of Ditsang, Earth Store Bodhisattva. I haven't heard any explanation of why he had that nickname. It's kind of a radical thing to have a nickname of a great archetypal bodhisattva. It'd be like somebody just being called, "Hey, Guan Yin," or "Hey, Manjushri." It's kind of a bit much, maybe. Ditsang was one of those great bodhisattvas, known for his great vow, and particularly going into really difficult realms like hell to save beings there. Ditsang goes in, you sometimes see pictures of Ditsang with flames all around him, like he's in this fiery hell going to rescue beings there. So maybe that was something about Luohan Guichen's practices. He would go into hell to help people, and so they called him Ditsang. And Ditsang first studied with Shui Feng, Xuan Sha's teacher, but was unsuccessful at penetrating the way, according to Andy Ferguson. Introduction here. It was Shui Feng's disciple, Xuan Sha, who is said to have brought Ditsang to full awakening. Through this story that I brought up a few weeks ago. Before I go into the story, though, part of the record, too, is that Xuan Sha passed on certain esoteric teachings known as Samaya that Ditsang then promoted throughout his life. And, you know, I don't know why he translated that section and didn't really go into it further. But I just started thinking about this teacher-student thing again, because it came up yesterday, and we're talking about this lineage that went from, started with Sherto and then on to through various generations down to Shui Feng and Xuan Sha, and now Ditsang. And Ditsang's student was Fa Yan, who started the Fa Yan House of Zen. Recently listening to this Tibetan teacher talk about teacher-student relationship, and said that this is kind of, it was an American teacher, but in a Tibetan tradition, who practiced with a Tibetan teacher for decades. And so he was talking about his understanding of that system, but in a kind of modern way. I think this was not from the old texts, I don't think. I think this was his interpretation. And he said there's three kinds of spiritual teachers, maybe not just in Buddhism, but maybe this could apply to all kinds of religions or spiritual traditions. And one is the knowledge teachers, basically teaching like texts. And the, you know, Buddhism and all spiritual traditions have a vast array of written teachings that are difficult to understand often. And so so there's always been a kind of oral tradition of interpreting sutras and Zen teachings and interpreting and expanding on these. So it's always needed people to do this. In fact, people wrote them. So just arriving, let me just mention this context that I'm starting this section on this one person's idea of three types of spiritual teachers. One who teaches knowledge from the sutras and the texts of a tradition. And so this could include like university professors and that might not be considered spiritual teachers, but they're in a very in-depth way often teaching like the texts, or often there's combinations. There's university professors that are disguised as professors, but they're actually Dharma teachers. I think of Jeffrey Hopkins, who's a great scholar and translator and university professor, but he was really steeped in practicing the tradition with his Tibetan teachers, and often in America it seems that usually the university professors of Buddhism, if they're practitioners of meditation and Buddhist tradition, they have to kind of keep that kind of secret. They don't like that in the universities. And this may be true of other religions too, I'm not sure. Maybe not if it's like, say, a Christian seminary. Maybe they're supposed to be part of the religion too. But if you're teaching outside of a seminary in a regular university, you're supposed to have a very objective view of what you're teaching. So if you have faith in a tradition, that's a very dubious situation because you might be biased. You might actually like think that it's a good thing instead of just some abstract thing that you're presenting. So yeah. Yeah, they're practitioners. I don't think it has to be clergy. Both of them are not university professors, so they don't have to keep it secret that they practice. And I think both of them are very devoted to their actual practice, that it's very complementary to their scholarship and their practice. So anyway, there's this first type of teacher, according to this author named Alexander Bertzin, that's like the teacher of basically interpreting words. And sometimes in Zen, this type of teacher gets a little bit dissed sometimes, I think, because a lot of these things are kind of making fun of the complicated teachings and saying, this is the separate transmission outside the scriptures. So, there's scripture teachers, but that's not Zen teachers. So Zen has a kind of unique relationship to those kind of scriptural teachers. But as this Tibetan practitioner was saying, and I think it's true for modern American Buddhism, we need to actually understand at least the basic teachings. We need presentation of the texts and teachings. So we need that type of teacher. And then the second type that was mentioned was the kind of daily life practice teacher, which is a little different. And hopefully there's some overlap between all these, but that's the one who's like, here's how to apply these teachings in your daily life. And I think that's the kind of thing that university professors are probably not supposed to do so much. That's getting sidetracked for them. That's all about what we're kind of trying to do. But in a university presentation, just understand this text like this. You can, if you want to apply it to your life, that's your own business. You can do that later. And those daily life teachers have to have some understanding of the teachings because it's they have to apply it, but it may not be nearly as much as the, you know, complicated teachings interpreters. And so that's a type of spiritual teacher. And then the third is how did he say it? Something like the teacher that offers empowerments. So this is maybe a little bit unique to Tibetan Buddhism, which is so much about receiving initiations and empowerments, and which often have to do with a text or a particular cycle, they call sadhana, a particular practice around a certain deity or a certain devotional text, but it's received. And also there's empowerments of practices, and there's also, it's sort of like an empowerment of a text they do too. They call it reading transmission. And so in order to really work with a text or study a text, the teacher will kind of formally recite the text. If it's really long, maybe, I don't know how they would do that, but if they're shorter, it's a reading, like reading transmission, and they got the reading transmission of that text from their teacher. And just like in our Zen lineage, the story is that was orally transmitted back from the time of Buddha, like if it's a sutra coming from Buddha, there was always this oral transmission, which there probably was, because writing wasn't so prevalent in those early days. But that even when after writing came to be, there was, it's a connection, a living connection to a text or a particular practice. And ordinations would be included in those. So I think in Zen, we do have empowerments and initiations. And the Tibetan term is abhisheka. I mean, the Sanskrit is abhisheka, and that's what they translate as like the lung, or I guess maybe the wang in Tibetan is a initiation into a certain practice. And I think that this is translation of abhisheka, and they're similar terms, which comes from like a coronation of a prince in esoteric Buddhism, use these Indian terms, Indian maybe kind of political terms, like a coronation of a prince with water. So in Soto Zen, we have this water sprinkling ceremony that we do for various initiation ceremonies, and we call that water sprinkling abhisheka, which is kind of esoteric Buddhist term, and it's kind of like an empowerment. And so this third type is like kind of outside the outside kind of practical understanding. You could even say there's this gradation from the first kind. It's very practical. Just teach me what the words say. You know, I don't understand what this says. Can you explain this for me? Very practical. The next one is like also practical, but it's very fluid. It's like how you're going to apply these things to your life is going to change in every situation. And then this empowerment initiation thing is kind of like esoteric in the sense that doesn't seem practical at all from the surface. From a very rational, maybe Western point of view, it seems like magic or just, you know, useless something. And yet we have this in our tradition. How we relate to that is each of us can find our way to relate to that kind of thing. But this teacher was saying that in the Tibetan tradition, that's what's, when they talk about guru yoga and practicing kind of like a devotional spirit towards the teacher, which is not necessarily even a living teacher. This could be done with like, you could do guru yoga with Dogen. In fact, Tibetan, it's often a combination of a living teacher blended with the like the great founders.
So mystics would be here.
Mystics, yeah, and like transmission outside words and letters, and
shamans would be part of this too.
Yeah, and maybe that would be mostly the third type. It doesn't, outside of a Buddhist tradition, initiations, so, I don't know, like a Christian ordination into some order might be considered that kind of thing, where it's like, you maybe learn nothing from that teacher, actually. Could be that, that you have different types of teachers, you could have these three types for these three different purposes. And I think it is like that sometimes in Zen tradition, like they'll have a big Jukai ceremony and they'll invite some senior abbot from some other temple to come to Eheji and do this initiation, but nobody even knows who they are really, and everybody just receives the precepts like for the 20th time or whatever. And it's more about that, that there's just some connection. I think this is also where lineage comes in. It's like this third type is connecting to a lineage, which in Tibetan Buddhism is highly important, and Zen is very similar in that way. And it's the realm where we can't talk about too much. We can't, it's not rational. And yet there's something, I think very beneficial that can happen there. So I thought of that when I heard that Xuanzha passed on these certain esoteric teachings known as Samaya that then his student Ditsang promoted throughout his life. Because in Tibetan Buddhism, this word Samaya is like the bond between the teacher and disciple. And there's like Samaya precepts. In Tibetan Buddhism, they have like the kind of small vehicle precepts, pratimoksha precepts for lay people and monastics that the Buddha taught in all vehicles, basic conduct precepts. Then they have bodhisattva precepts, different ones than we do, but they have these, they distinguish these two, and they have this third level, like samaya precepts, or you know, if we're talking about the three vehicles, it's like the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana. And each of them has their own sets of precepts. And the Samaya precepts are a lot about, like, not violating the teacher-student bond. And they're all kind of like internal mind precepts more. In fact, I think there's that gradation in general that small vehicle precepts are more about outward conduct. Bodhisattva precepts are this mix of kind of outward conduct, but with the spirit, we practice the spirit of like not killing. And you can violate it in the mind. They say with bodhisattva precepts, you can, if you really want to kill, but you're just restraining your body from killing, that's still going against it. So much harder to practice than the, you know, it might look on the surface like easier because there's all this flexibility, but if you say that even a thought of harming others is like kind of breaking the precept in a way that makes it much harder than the small vehicle. It's very literal, so like, I can hate these people just as long as I don't beat them up. It's like, you know, and then these, you know, tantric or samaya precepts are like, I don't even know if there's anything, I guess there's external things, but they're mostly about this inner spirit of commitment and inconceivable bond and And harmony, they're a lot about keeping harmony with one's fellow practitioners and teachers.
I think modern medicine would put placebo effectiveness.
How so?
Well, a sense of a belief in a process or a procedure or a ritual is just as effective. I think the study done on this, 23% was the measured effect of placebos, and like 23.5% was the measured effect of drugs in that area. So the placebo effect is enormously powerful in allowing for healing transformation. So in this realm, when you have the sense of magical empowerment, the act of accepting that without understanding can have a beneficial effect. That's orderly.
The only thing is that the placebo thing kind of makes it sound like it's from a rational point of view. We say, you know, we really know that it's just a placebo, that there's nothing really behind it, and it's just to increase people's faith, for example. Like there's this story, old Indian story about this woman who really wants a relic of Buddha to worship the relic to increase her faith, and her son goes to India or something like this, and really wants to bring back a Buddha relic for his mom, and he's about to leave the country and he hasn't found one, so he finds a tooth of a dog and brings it back and says, look, I brought you the Buddha's relic from India. And she's like ecstatic, right? And like, oh, thank you so much, this is what I always wanted. And she just I don't know what worships is, you know, but she like relates to this relic. And I think this is the idea of these relics that make the rounds through our land occasionally, is that they're to increase faith. I think they're like, if you have some belief, like this is the Buddha's everlasting body, you know, worship this in remembrance of me. Take this in remembrance of me. This is actually the Buddha's body, and it's shining, bright colored relic that proves that the Buddha transformed his internal body through meditation, and so on. However people take it, I think it's about increasing faith. So, and the story with this woman is that she realized total awakening through her devotion and faith opening to this dog tooth. So in a way, that's like the placebo. It didn't matter what it was. It was just she had to have faith. She had to relate to it in a way that opened her trust.
It's closely related to surrendering. And a lot of traditions, including our own, talk about letting go. And the sense that you can say, well, we do it here every day. Frustrations is a form of this. You know, making a private, unwitnessed observation that this little thing out here, little altar, nobody sees anybody doing that, but I saw you do it. But you didn't know anybody was looking at you. But physiologically, something actually occurs, which, I mean, let's just say that's worse or less authentic than what occurs when we do zazen.
Yeah.
Or anything else. So the act of surrendering, I think, is the beneficial thing that we do. When we get superstitious, though, and attach ourselves to the belief, then it gets a little wonky. But I think the act of just saying, I'm going to participate in this form, can be very beneficial.
Yeah, it's dangerous territory because we can believe in something. And then we're getting stuck. And yet if we go too far to the other extreme, it's like, well, it's just a bunch of old time superstition and this is no longer appropriate. Then we lose something too. Right? That's another extreme. So I think you're right that actually in our practice, it's like all our ritual forms, all our services are in this realm, I think. And particularly, you know, the, in Sesshin, we're chanting the names of the lineage. It's very much about that too. And it's like, I feel like it's, you know, it could just be like, well, we're just trying to remember who they are and respect them in a practical way. And in another way, it's like invoking the lineage and connecting with it in some mysterious way.
Well, when we say we chant 3 times 10 directions, we are bringing everything into this moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there is no past or future or there, but everything is just like concentrated right now. And so reciting a lineage, doing these observances, doing all these kinds of things, it can get screwy, and it has gotten screwy. But as a personal matter, it can be a vast opening.
Mm-hmm.
To, I don't know.
Yeah.
Being content there, I think, is very close to suffering.
And seeing how it affects us. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like one of our strong lines that I sometimes wonder about when newcomers come to service is, you know, the mantra of great magic. The unexcelled mantra that is true, not false. The great magic mantra. Here we go. Gate, gate, para gate, para san gate, bodhisvaha. And, you know, it has this very, that whole end of the Heart Sutra has this very magical kind of invocation feeling. And yeah, there it is. We do that. So, so it's, yeah, we don't know about how these, we hear a lot of these story interactions between these, and just hearing this little thing about this samaya being passed along, I thought, interesting, I wonder what that was about in those old days. So this is Ditsang and Shren Sha and Ditsang and this, you know, when I brought this up a few weeks ago, I didn't realize that it was Shren Sha that we would be studying in this fascicle, but here it is, and it seems that Shuansha was at least interested in mind only, if he wasn't a total mind only guy. So Shuansha questions Ditsang, his student, saying, "The three realms are mind only," quoting the Avatamsaka Sutra. "How do you understand this?" Do you remember this one? This story? So let's bring up this this old teaching that's important in our tradition and gets quoted a lot and talk about it. The three realms, meaning the whole universe, all realms of living beings and everything in that they interact with. We could just say the whole world, the whole universe is mind only. How do you understand this? And Ditsang pointed to a chair and said, "What do you call this?" And Xuan Sha says, "A chair." And Ditsang says, well, Andy Ferguson translates it as, "Then the master, you can't say that in the three realms there is mind, only mind, because there's a chair." You know, you didn't call it mind, you call it a chair. So you can't, well, if you call it a chair, then you can't say that in the three realms there's only mind. I think the other translation that how I read it last time was, what do you call that? A chair? Well, then you don't understand mind only. You don't understand that the three realms are mind only. like, you know, kind of like, you don't get it, teacher. This is a little different feeling when he says, well, if you call it a chair, then you can't say that the three realms are only mind. And this word understanding is a kind of this loaded word in here too, which gets brought up again. So then Xuanzha tries a new approach and says, I say that it's bamboo and wood. What do you say, Dizan? And Dizan says, I also say it's just bamboo and wood. In other words, or one way to interpret this would be that it's actually not a chair. A chair is a mind-made construction of something that's just actually a collection of bamboo and wood, that then when we see it put together in a certain way, we call it chair. So then instead of calling it a chair, how about we call it just bamboo and wood? What do you call it? And Dizan kind of looks like he agrees with this. I also call it bamboo and wood. It's not a chair. That's just a mind, mental construction to call it a chair. And then, so when Dizan says, I also say it's made of bamboo and wood, then Xuanzha says, I've searched across the great earth for a person who understands Buddha Dharma, but I haven't found even one. So as many of these stories, including the one that's the center of this Dogen fascicle, the punchline at the end of the story is highly interpretable and could be read like various ways that are often opposite from each other. So does that mean Xuanzha is criticizing Dizan for like, you know, you also say it's bamboo wood? Well then, that's not it either. And I've been looking for someone who understands Buddha Dharma and I haven't found one. Or, you know, anything you say is just going to be, you know, reifying something, making something. So, you know, and I asked you to say something. I said, I call it bamboo and wood. What do you call it? If you say anything, that's not going to be it. Therefore, there's no person who understands Buddha Dharma. And if they did understand it, it couldn't be expressed in words. That'd be one way to read it. Or, very similarly, it's like, nobody can understand, meaning like, or know something, because in order to understand or know something in the way we usually talk about understanding and knowing, it's like there's the person and then there's the thing that they're understanding, and there's that separation there. So if we talk about Buddha Dharma and a person understanding Buddha Dharma, that can't be found. Ultimately, that can't be found. There's no people who understand Buddha Dharma. Conventionally, we could say, well, it looks like that person understood what that meant, but that's not really Buddha Dharma. Buddha Dharma is not something that can be understood or known by a person.
What if a student said, to the question, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
If he'd answered, it is this.
Mm. Yeah, sometimes they do say it like that. It is this. And then the teacher could say, to say it's this, this is the mark. So those conversations do happen, as we know, right? So, and I think that's the nice thing about that, because that's the closest we can get, maybe, is to say, just this is it. But actually, even that misses the mark. Just this is already saying too much, is understanding too much, is knowing too much. So ultimately, in the end, I've searched the whole earth for a person who understands Buddhadharma, but I haven't found one. You know, it sounds on the surface like I'm looking for somebody to understand, you know, and they can be my successor, and like I understand. That's kind of on the surface how it sounds, but you know, I take it actually as I haven't found one, and I never will, and I'm so happy that such a one can never be found, including me, that nobody can understand Buddhadharma as something outside themselves, as something understandable. And it's a funny story about mind only, because it doesn't seem to go that deep, I feel like. Because when they say, well, what do you call it? I call it a chair. In a way, that's okay to say that. We have we use language. That's an imputation of a chair. We don't stop, well, if we're practicing with mind only, we don't stop calling things chairs. We don't stop using language. But to know that we just call it a chair. So in this case, you know, what do you call that? A chair. Is a little different than what is that? It's a chair. It's not really a chair, but we do call it a chair. And it's okay to call it a chair. So like in the Diamond Sutra, you know, there's that whole repetitive way of talking where they say, you know, chair, as no chair, I teach it, therefore it's called chair, something like that. I have to look at the Diamond Sutra, but it's like, it's not this, and then it was, therefore we call it this. And maybe the key, maybe it's like, you could even put call in italics. There is no chair, therefore we call it a chair. Which is different than saying it is a chair. And this is the way that words and language create the world. And it is, you know, it does play with the mind-only idea to say it's not really a chair, it's just bamboo and wood. But mind-only, of course, goes much deeper than that. It's also not bamboo and wood. Those are just more words and names. What is it? We can't say. So, Ditsang, later, when Ditsang was teaching, he said, worthy practitioners of Zen, our school's essential vehicle, the Buddha Dharma, comes from and is realized through nothing other than the names and words from your own mouths. It's just what you say and do. Well, that's a nice teaching in itself, just that Buddha Dharma, the great Buddha Dharma that we're giving ourselves to in this practice, just comes from like words coming from people's mouths and actions that they do. There's no thing actually that is the Buddha Dharma other than just words and actions. It's created by people and ideas, and you know, and then we like can build zendos and things like this, but there's no Buddha Dharma in the you know, the wood that makes up the zendo. It's just putting things together in particular ways according to our ideas, and that's all it actually is. Which seems somehow amazing, feeling like that's where like I'm basing my whole life on this thing called like Buddha Dharma, but it's actually not anything. It's not something. It's not, it's just a bunch of people's ideas. So like, that seems like a weird thing to like devote yourself to. Weird. And yet...
It is a bunch of people's ideas. We call it a bunch of people's ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But having ideas
mm-hmm.
is something that transcends ideas. Having ideas. And a lot of people having ideas,
mm-hmm.
having ideas about the observation of their consciousness and the consciousness of others, in there somewhere, and maybe in this thoroughly established realm is the Buddha Dharma, right?
Well, Buddha Dharma has all three characters. But also, everything is actually just words and ideas. The whole, what we think of as the, as other things other than Buddha Dharma, like if you're a doctor and you're doing a heart surgery on someone, it seems like, well, that's much more tangible than just Buddha Dharma. It's a bunch of ideas. But actually, according to Buddha Dharma, it's exactly the same, that it's a bunch of ideas and enactment of them, actions coming from them, including heart surgery or whatever. It's just that to most people, it looks a lot more tangible, like you're really doing something. Whereas Zen, like, it doesn't look like, I mean, it, like we do things like build a room like this. Now, this looks like something. This is cool. We've got this room, but what's this room for? We don't even know. It's for, like, doing something that we don't even know what it is. Being totally devoted is something that we can't say what it is. It doesn't even seem to have some tangible effect. And maybe it does, but the ones that we think are tangible aren't really it anyway. So I just got this hit on this when the, you know, that the school's essential vehicle, the Buddha Dharma itself, comes from and is realized through nothing other than names and words from your own mouths. Like, you people are creating Buddha Dharma right now. It's just what you say and do. You come here and use words like, in quotes, tranquility, reality, perfection, or constancy, the thoroughly established. I don't know if constancy is a translation of this, but it sounds very much like perfection and constancy as these ultimate truths, the thoroughly established character. Worthy practitioners, what is this that you call tranquil or real? What is it that's perfect or constant? What is the thoroughly established, quote unquote? Those of you here on pilgrimage, you must test the principle of what I'm saying. Let's be open about it. You've stored up a bunch of sounds, forms, names, and words inside your minds. And he goes on. There's no doubt about it. Sounds and forms assault us at every moment. Do you directly face them or not? If you face them directly, then your diamond-solid concept of self will melt away. How can this be? Because these sounds penetrate your ears and these forms pierce your eyes, you're overwhelmed by conditions, you're killed by delusion. There's not enough room inside you for all these sounds and forms. If you don't face them directly, then how will you manage all these sounds and forms? Do you understand? Face them or not face them, see for yourself. So sounds and forms are assaulting us every moment. I think it's a great image. In Sashin, sometimes we can start to feel that way. The physical difficulties and the in the form of thoughts, and sometimes it sounds, and the world of the sensory world of objects sometimes feels like an assault when we get overwhelmed by these conditions and objects. And so he just says, directly face them. Meditating on the other dependent character, the appearance of everything coming at us all the time, outside of our control. I remember Dogen said, quoted a monk coming to a teacher saying, when thousands and millions of objects assault us, each moment, how can we deal with this? What should we do? And the teacher said, don't try to control them. And then Dogen's comment was, what's coming at us is not objects at all, but Buddha Dharma. It's it's not outside us. The objects that are assaulting us are not outside the mind. So then how to work with this? First, directly face them. Become very intimate with all the sounds and forms that are coming each moment. And Zazen offers us this great chance to do that. After a pause, Ditsang continued, "Perfection, constancy, tranquility, reality. Who talks like this? Normal people in the village don't talk like this. It's just some old sages that talk this way and a few of their wicked disciples that spread it around." So now you don't know good from bad. You're absorbed in perfection and reality. Almost like you're forgetting your life because you're so into the thoroughly established. Some say, "I don't possess the mysterious excellence of our order's style." But Shakyamuni Buddha didn't have a tongue. So this is a Zen take on getting too into concepts like this. And yet, he's creating a bunch more of them just every time he moves his tongue. Even though Shakyamuni Buddha didn't have a tongue, and his tongue is kind of out of control, still, everything that's said leaves something to grasp onto. And then, in another dialogue later, a monk asked Ditsang, "What is your house style?" The phrase, the wind of the house, the wind of the house is like the style of a particular lineage or school. In this case, they're talking about, you know, your particular Zen style. So this would be a common question that they asked in the old days. What is Ditsang's, Luohan's, family style, house style? And Ditsang said, "I can't tell you." The monk said, "Why not?" And Ditsang said, "Because that's my house style." That was a nice one. "What, you asked me about my house style. What is it? I can't tell you." That's it. And so that's a lot like his teacher who told him, you know, "I've searched for a person who understands Buddha Dharma but haven't found one."
Is that the same answer in Buddha Dharma as "I don't know"?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of this in the end, and I feel like from the sutra point of view, the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra is pointing in a very kind of complicated and wordy way at this very same point. The thoroughly established character is don't know mind. It's saying it's the absence of the imputational, which is like knowing things are things. The absence of that on this dependently arising appearance of ungraspable experience. So it's like the fact that we don't know and can't know anything is like the thoroughly established. So it's nice to use both languages. It's nice to have a class on the sutra where we get really technical and very accurate about describing this mechanism of perception and how we grasp. And then it's nice to have the refreshing style of Zen, which just goes directly to, "Who are you? I don't know." Sometimes if we don't understand how it all works in studied in a very careful way, we can, "I don't know" isn't so powerful. It doesn't affect us so much. "Oh, maybe he was just being lazy. I don't know who I am." Or you know, apart from the four negations and the thousands of propositions defining Buddha Dharma and ultimate truth, what is directly the meaning of Bodhidharma is coming from the West. And the teacher says, I have a headache today. Can you go ask my student? A direct presentation. And he missed it, so he went and had to ask the other person. So finally, let's open up the central story of this One Bright Pearl fascicle. Xuan Sha, after attaining the way, this is the fourth paragraph. After attaining the way, he would instruct others by saying, the whole universe is one bright pearl, one warm jewel. Once a monk asked him, you have a saying, the whole universe is one bright pearl. How can a student like me understand that? The master replied, the whole universe is one bright pearl. What's the use of understanding?
I've been reading another translation.
The Ta-Nehisi one?
This translation just right there can come straight out.
I mentioned on an earlier day, I said, I generally really like the Kaz translations, and it's our family style translations. I try to choose those, but this one I couldn't go with. I didn't work saying that one, yeah. There's several, and they're all almost like this, just that one is quite different. I'll bring it up in a minute. That one too, but what's the use of understanding? So the next day, the Xuan Sha, the master, asked the monk, what's your understanding of the whole universe is one bright pearl? The monk said, the whole universe is one bright pearl. What's the use of understanding? And Xuan Sha said, I know that you're alive in the Black Mountain Cave of Demons. That's the central story. It forms one of the koans and dogens, 300 collection. And now Dogen will, for the rest of this essay, of these two pages, will line by line, word by word, comment in his maddening way on this story of Xuan Sha. So just to hear a couple other translations. I think Shohaku Okamura translates that line, which I think is one of the real key lines, is that what's the use of understanding? He translates it exactly the same. What's the use of understanding? Thomas Cleary says, the monk asked, I hear you have a saying that the whole world in 10 directions is one bright jewel. How can a student understand this? The master said, the whole world in 10 directions is one bright jewel. What does it have to do with understanding? That's almost the same. The next day, the master asked, the whole world in 10 directions is one bright jewel. How do you understand? The monk said, the whole world in 10 directions is one bright pearl jewel. What does it have to do with understanding? The master said, I knew you were making a living in a ghost cave in the mountain of darkness. I think this last line, too, is highly interpretable and translated in quite a few different ways. It literally says, whole world... 10 directions, whole universe, whole world, whole universe, in 10 directions, which is, east, west, north, south, the four midway points, and up and down. 10 directions, three times. whole world. The Kaz Ta-Nehisi and Ed Brown translation. The monk asks, I heard that you said the entire world in 10 directions is just one bright pearl. How should I understand this? Xuan Xia said, the entire world of 10 directions is just one bright pearl. What do you do with your understanding? Which is kind of clunkier. I didn't quite know what they were intending with that, but recently I feel like maybe what they're trying to bring out is kind of like if you put you in italics. So the monk says, how should I understand this? Xuan Xia says, kind of my understanding, the way I understand it is just like you heard it. The entire world in 10 directions is one bright pearl. What do you do with your understanding? Kind of like, that's how I do understand it. What do you do with your understanding? Does that make sense? It's a completely different kind of meaning being presented.
So you have the student, this is the way it caught me. Mm-hmm. You have a student that says, you go around saying this thing about a pearl. How can a student like me understand that?
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if what the master then says could be like this. The whole universe is one bright pearl. What has understanding got to do with that?
Yeah. That's the way that it seems like it's usually read.
Yeah, like, you know, like, the reality is bigger than what you can understand about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why are you fiddling with understanding?
Exactly, yeah.
What does understanding have to do with that? Why are you asking the sillier questions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially it's quite, if it was something like, if his phrase that he was always saying was something like, the thoroughly established is the absence of the imputational in the other dependent. How can I understand that? Then he might say, well, I probably should explain this to you because it's a pretty weird way of talking. But to say the whole universe in 10 directions is one bright pearl, and then, you know, that's so complete, that's so exposed, that's so all-encompassing, that's so straightforward, that says it all. You know, don't add or subtract the slightest bit from that, please. And so to say, that's how it is. How can I understand? Well, I think it was in deep sincerity that these monks asked, like, I hear that, and maybe even he felt like, well, I do understand what the words mean, and I've heard a lot of Zen things like that. But like, I really, now, let me level with me, teacher, you know. How can I really understand this? And the teacher could say, okay, now listen, you know, just don't think good or bad. At this moment was your original face or something. Give him something to do, some further question. In a way, it was a further question, right? He said, what's it got to do with understanding? So he did turn another question back on him. But nothing, no other, you know, footnotes or elaborations. Just, how do you understand it? The whole universe in 10 directions is one bright pearl. What's it got to do with understanding? Or what's the use of understanding? It's a slightly different twist about utilitarianism, you know, kind of like, I want to, like, get some use out of this Zen thing that we do. So, like, tell me how to understand it so I can use that understanding for my enlightenment and helping people. And, oh, what's the use of understanding? So that's a kind of nice thing about usefulness. You know, as Kodo Suwaki Roshi says, Zazen is good for nothing. Totally useless.
What's the student's reply?
The student says, the entire world, the next day, Xuan Xia asked, the entire world is just won by pearl. How do you understand this? The monk says, the entire world in 10 directions is won by pearl, the same thing. How? What do you do with your understanding? And then his reply, it sounds quite different here too. Xuanzha says, I see that you've worked out a way to get through the demon's cave in the Black Mountain. So a lot of these answers are like, you can't tell if they're praise or blame. It seems like there he kind of emphasized the praise, like made it more obviously praise. And I think that Dogen, in his comments, often takes what sounds like a blaming statement and interprets it as praise just to be Dogen, just to take up the opposite point of view for the sake of fullness. And vice versa, sometimes if it sounds like praise, Dogen interprets it as blame. And so there are footnotes on this Black Mountain Cave of Demons, which is this Zen phrase that does crop up here and there and other places that's pointing towards, delusion in general, like it sounds like this dark cave where you're just, it's all damp and you're cramped in this deluded dark little world where there's no light shining, and a bunch of your own demons are flying around in your head in a cave. So delusion in general, but then particularly in Zen, it's applied to getting stuck in like emptiness, getting stuck in some ultimate view, getting stuck in like nothingness, or like meditation, trance. Getting stuck in like stillness and inactivity. It also had this feeling of like, or you know, the zazen is maybe very, very restful and very peaceful, very dark and comfy with these like kind of like little demons circling around in their like little daydreams. But it's not clear, bright and light. It's kind of dark and dull and kind of, but very, because it's very peaceful, if somebody starts coming around with a stick or something and says, wake up everybody, tell me how it is now! They'd say, like, don't disturb me, that's like adding something extra, just let me rest. That kind of dark cave. The one that, like, Hakuin is constantly railing on. And kind of that Hakuin Zenji would criticize the Soto Zen style of just sitting as being too dark and dull and not actively expressed enough through stories like this. So whether, one is, I know that you're alive among the demons of the dark cave. The other one is, I knew you were making a living in the ghost cave in the mountain of darkness. And then I see you worked out a way to get through the demon's cave on the Black Mountain. So you're alive in it means like that's where you live. You could hear it as that's where you're living in this. And you're living there because you're, all you do is repeat my words back. You know, I asked you the next day for like a fresh understanding. The same question you asked me, and even though you're very devoted to just, you learned this answer from me, and you're very devoted to just repeat it back, that doesn't work anymore. It needs to be yours today, and fresh and new. And so, therefore, you're just hanging out in a dark cave. Or you could hear it as total praise, as like, exactly, what more could you say than what I already said? If you say anything other than just repeating back what's it got to do with understanding, you're already elaborating too much. So even though you are pretty deluded and you generally live in this black, dark cave, you've got some life there. or you found a way to get through it. Or a third possibility is, of many, infinite possibilities, but another would be that you are actually in this dark cave of delusion, and you're kind of stuck there, but I see, actually, that you're truly alive there. You don't see it. All you can do is repeat my answer, but even in your repeating my answer, I see your true life, your Buddha nature, your life in the middle of your delusion. So we'll hear what Dogen does with it, whether that's helpful or not.
Mm-hmm. Xuan Shao was said here not to have been learned.
Yeah, that's okay. True.
Which, so when he says now the whole universe is a bright pearl, mm-hmm. he's not talking about some literary illusion. He's probably talking from actually having looked at a pearl. And this other guy is basically taking a literary allusion to a pearl. He's saying, well, you said the pearl, and you know, how do I understand this? And I'll bring it back to my own experience. When I was a kid in Key West, Florida, I was just a little kid in second grade. I became totally captivated by the inside of shells, mother of pearl. Because I could look at it, and I could move it around, and all kinds of things were happening, you know, colors and shapes and everything else. You know, and I can almost see that if you look at a pearl very closely, it ceases to become a pearl. It contains all the information you need to know about the whole universe in terms of how we construct it. And so the whole universe is a pearl. But it doesn't come that way if you look at a catalog and it says pearl and you're referring to that. When you say, what do you mean by that? So this doesn't entail actually looking here. I mean, the act of looking very closely at something, it's got a name.
Well, we could see it as, you know, I think it's a beautiful image for, and again, it's maybe not literally like an oyster pearl. It's just that it's like a shining round jewel or bead is maybe more accurate translation. It's the word that they use for mala beads. They call it in Japanese jutsu. Is the Japanese name for mala, and it's the ju of myoju, ika myoju. So I forget what the ju is, but it's like mala beads. But then some of the translators said they chose pearl because it's a great image for the way that it shines, and it's like lustrous. But that's interesting that I actually wasn't seeing it that way, as like actually looking at a small pearl and saying the whole universe is right there.
Yeah, you can see impermanence, you can see interconnectedness, you can see the unity of differences. I mean, yeah. It's all right there.
Yeah, we could totally take it that way. We could take it as a small pearl and that all of it's right there, or we could take it as this vast, inconceivable, round, you know, seamless sphere of the universe shining in its radiance as a kind of like, you know, a metaphor, a poetic image.
Well, except that the process of looking at this little pearl is no different than the process of looking at the whole thing.
Yeah, either way is the same in the end.
Same thing. So if you get an oh wow here, mm-hmm. you can go, this whole thing is the same thing.
Yeah.
It's contained in the whole thing.
Yeah. Which is kind of nice to call it, and it does seem to be referring to a small round object. They could have said the whole universe in 10 directions is like, you know, the blazing sun billions of miles across, or some, or you know, something larger. You can pick it up very small. No distinction between large and small in this realm.
It could be anything.
Yeah. Yeah.